believe on. I think we have to discuss this very carefully, seeing how to also protect the way of development of each country also, no?
Well, thank you very much, Lucho.
We're out of time. Today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank our assistant producer, Alicia Vargas, for her editing of today's show. I'd like to thank our board op, Gary Baca, and also thank the Alliance for Global Justice, in particular, their Echo Solidarity series. If you'd like.
And this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. It is now 5 p.m. Stay tuned for Advocating for Justice with Arthur Schwartz coming up.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Arthur Schwartz on Advocating for Justice here on WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. I come to you every week and I start my show with a pitch. And that pitch is that our radio station is on the air only because people make donations. People donate the money that makes it possible for this station to run 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, without any commercials, without any corporate underwriting, without anybody being able to influence what we say other than our listeners. So please go to WBAI.org. Become a WBA buddy in the name of the show. That means you'll pledge some monthly amount. It could be $10 or $20 and keep us on the air. It costs about $1.25 million to run this radio station 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. We have to pay our staff. We have to pay our rent in our office. We have to pay for the antenna that our signal goes through. That's very expensive. And we need listeners to support us to get us there. Folks who are listening, who have been listening for the last 63 years, have kept us on the air for 63 years. And we'd like to be here for another 63 more. So please make a donation. Go to WBI.org. Go to the donate button and make a donation. So today we're going to talk about hospital closings, and in particular, the threatened one at New York Eye and Ear Hospital. Our guest today is Paul Lee, who told me he was going to could he wear his scrubs on the radio, and I said sure, but he got out of his scrubs anyway. Paul is got his MD from the University of Chicago. He did his internship at the Lankenau Medical Center. He did his residency in ophthalmology at New York Eye and Ear Infirmary and has a certification in ophthalmology. And he is one of the leaders of an effort to keep New York Eye and Ear Infirmary open. Welcome, Paul.
Hi, Arthur. Thank you for having me on the show.
So can you just give us a little bit about this, because then I'm going to play a clip from the president of the hospital about how wonderful the hospital is. But what is going on there?
So to kind of give you a little bit of a historical perspective, you know, Mount Sinai merged with Continuum Health, which was a consortium of hospitals, which included Beth Israel, New York Ioneer, St. Luke's, and Roosevelt in 2013. So if you look at New York Ioneer in the early 2000s to 2013, we were highly profitable, not just a profit, but we were super busy. We were considered the place in the city to take care of the sickest patients, the poorest patients, the wealthiest patients. We took them all. We had a resident clinic that took everybody, and then we had faculty, geographic faculty practices that were located within the building. We had ORs, we had research, all in one roof, and we were really the show in town when it came to complex ophthalmology cases, ophthalmology trauma, metal objects going into the eye, training. We were training the best and brightest ophthalmologists. After 2013, when Mount Sinai merged or took over in a way, New York Ioneer, what we've seen is a slow, and I believe, and some of us also believe, a slow and deliberate dismantling of New York Ioneer. A lot of the top talent has left. A lot of the services have, well, ENT and radiology left. The 24-hour ophthalmology trauma ER was moved out. And the number of surgeries, the number of visits that we were doing in 2013 to now is dramatically less. So we've seen this slow draining of talent, draining of services since 2013, which is, to be completely honest, heartbreaking to see. Because when you walk through the halls of New York Ioneer in 2011, 2012, it was electric. It was magical. Really, the mission and the focus of everybody in that building, and from the staff, you know, cleaning the floors, to the nurses, to the doctors, we were very focused. We were dedicated to doing our best for the patients that came through those doors. And I've been witnessing this and just trying, you know, just in just disbelief as it goes. It's a very subtle but slow degradation. And what happened was in 2021, there was a town hall that was widely attended by led by Jeremy Bowl, Liz Selman, and Jim Tsai. So Jeremy Bowl is, his position is CEO of Mount Sinai Downtown. James Tsai is the president of New York Ioneer, and Liz Selman is the COO or CFO of Mount Sinai Downtown. They had a public town hall in the fall of 2021 where they announced plans to transform New York Ioneer.
All right. I'm going to stop you there.
Sure.
Because I want people to hear what was Dr. Tsai saying before that. So, okay. Randy, if you could play this little clip. It's from Dr. Tsai. I'm not sure where this, it's like a commercial. I think it was on the 100th anniversary of New York Ioneer. They were doing commercials on TV and radio. And here, this is Dr. Tsai, who's then the president of New York Ioneer, talking about the hospital, which, by the way, for our listeners, is on the corner of 2nd Avenue and 14th Street.
What makes an innovator is someone who is not satisfied with the status quo. Someone who is always wanting to explore and investigate. Someone who looks outside the box. New York Ioneer stands among the great specialty hospitals because of all the innovations, all the discoveries that have occurred here. We're very proud of our history, our heritage. My name is Dr. James Tsai. I'm president of New York Ioneer Infirmary of Mount Sinai and system chair of ophthalmology at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. What made this job at New York Eye and Ear very special is the ability to really make a difference by leading what I think is one of the top specialty hospitals in America. We've been a leader in really transforming the care for patients. We've also been a leader in educating physicians and really keeping the focus on developing cutting-edge technologies to help patients either maintain their sight or restore their sight. New York Eye and Ear will be the first department in the United States to receive a surgical robot for ophthalmology. We're hoping that this will give us a better understanding of how to deliver certain targeted agents for therapies. Vision and hearing are our two bedrocks. However, we have expanded our role in plastic surgery, and we have also introduced a new program, our gender affirmation surgery program. I think it's important for our hospital to make an impact because we see that there's a large unmet need. Vision is so precious, and if we can save the vision in these patients, I think we feel that we have made a difference.
So there's 2019, mm-hmm. which is just before the pandemic, right? Yeah. Not the world changed it during the pandemic, but not we didn't have less of a need for hospitals. So now let's go back. There was a meeting, Jeremy Bowles, who's the head of Mount Sinai, mm-hmm. which is maybe the largest hospital in New York, if not second largest, and Dr. Tsai. And what happened?
In 2021, they had a fall. In the fall of 2021, they had a town hall where they invited all staff, faculty, and even alums to, they broadcast it to their kind of the, you know, New York Eye and Ear community, which is a pretty large, you know, list of people, highly attended. And in this meeting, they say that New York Eye and Ear is running into immense financial challenges because, a lot of the surgery now is being pushed to the outpatient side of the hospital, outside of hospitals. And that due to the impending financial doom that New York Eye and Ear is going to face, they're going to have to relocate services out of its current location, split up some of the surgery. So the surgery that's being performed by residents in our resident clinic, which is mainly Medicaid and self-pay patients, have those cases be done at Beth Israel. And then because there's a faculty practice at New York Eye and Ear, the faculty practice will operate at an ASC that Mount Sinai was going to be involved in starting. So
what's an ASC?
I'm sorry, Ambulatory Surgery Center. So
that would be a new place or the one that's on Union Square?
A new one specifically for ophthalmology. So, you know, a lot of questions and concerns about this plan. I was fortunate. So I reached out to Jim. Dr. Tsai and I have, you know, a very open line of communication, and I reached out to him immediately and I said, look, what's going on here? This is really concerning. You know, moving us out has huge implications to our patients, to our ability to, you know, achieve our mission as well as we have. He said, fine, then why don't you meet with Jeremy and Liz? You can go ahead and meet with them. So I met with them and I expressed my concerns. And, you know, I was hoping it was the beginning of what I thought would be kind of a partnership where we could try to, you know, come up with some type of solution for New York Eye and Ear. But after several meetings with them, I got the sense that they're position as far as New York Eye and Ear remaining in its current location was not flexible and was not negotiable. And so I was hoping that was flexible and negotiable, but about three or four meetings into meeting with them, I recognized that it was not. So I had to kind of pull back because I said, you know what, I'm not going to be able to move forward because I think that we have to come up with a plan where we can stay where we are. Through a patient.
Let me ask you something. New York Eye and Ear, it's a building that goes three quarters of the way from Second Avenue to First Avenue on 14th Street, right? Mm-hmm. And it has inpatient beds.
It does.
About how many?
Not many. I mean, it's listed on the certificate of need application of about 60, but I think in actuality, it's around 10 or 20.
So is most of the surgery that goes on there outpatient surgery anyway?
Yes.
But what's special about that building and the setup there that is worth saving, that Dr. Tsai was talking about in this little clip?
Yeah, well, so, I mean, first of all, the history of us being in that one location on 2nd Avenue and 14th Street, which is a very accessible location in Manhattan. There's subway lines and bus lines. So it's easy to get to, number one, and it has been for so many years. And that's partly why we've achieved, you know, the ease of access has allowed us to be attractive to many patients. And we've been there for so long. So, you know, my first immediate response is, if you move us, it's going to be hard for our patients to go to a different location, a new location, you know, especially since we've been there for so long. It's not an insurmountable, move, but it's a big move, and we really need to be sure that we want to go do this, you know. So that's what's special about it. And also what's special about it is that we are doing everything in one site, which is unique for ophthalmology. We are doing our surgery. We're seeing our patients. We're doing our research. Not all of our, but, you know, there's research that's done up in Mount Sinai, uptown, but we're doing everything in one site. And that's very convenient for our patients. If a lot of times when you go to see your ophthalmologist, they won't be doing surgery in the same place that you see them in your office. If you have to get a procedure done, they'll tell you to go somewhere else. We're very unique in that when our patients come to see us at that location, they're going to go also, if they need a procedure, they're going to go back to that same location, which makes it very easy, convenient for our patients. So that's what makes it unique. And that's what's, you know, allowed us to thrive, because we have a very unique model.
So just to station ID, this is Arthur Schwartz on Advocating for Justice on WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. And we're talking to Dr. Paul Lee about the threatened closure of New York Eye and Ear Hospital by its parent, Mount Sinai. All right. So you were talking about, you got this information, and then what did you and others start to do?
So once I figured out that we were facing up against a very determined plan by Mount Sinai to move and split up New York Eye and Ear, you know, I got very lucky because a patient of mine told me, and I told her about my struggle, you know, my concerns and this mission that I'm trying to stop, or this plan that I'm trying to stop. One of the buildings on the New York Eye and Ear campus is historically a very older historic building. And we had always thought amongst the faculty and the staff and alums, if we could landmark that building, at least that'll prevent it from being completely demolished. And even if they move us out, that piece of history will remain and be preserved. And I was fortunate enough to partner with Village Preservation Society, which has had success in landmarking buildings in that area. I partnered with Andrew Berman, who's the executive director of a Village Preservation Society, to put a request in to the Landmark Preservation Commission, which is a branch of under New York City mayor. Because of my introduction to Andrew Berman, Andrew introduced me to Harvey Epstein. And this really created the beginning.
Harvey Epstein, by the way, is the assembly member whose district ends at 2nd Avenue and 14th Street.
Yeah, I mean, he's very close. I don't know if he's actually, I never got confirmation that our hospital's in his district.
No, but it is. I know it because I'm the Democratic district leader in the district over, and I end it. Oh, no, I end at 1st Avenue, so it's not in Harvey's. So it's in Deborah Glick, Assemblymember Deborah Glick's district.
Okay, so I was introduced to Harvey through Andrew because of this proposal to landmark the building. And I talked to Harvey a little bit more about our bigger concern, and not just landmarking the building, but preserving the services, keep staying there on one site. And he was amazing. We would not be where we are without Harvey. He heard us. He said, I don't like this. It doesn't sound good for the community. Let me see what I can do. And he built a coalition of local elected officials. And really one thing led to another. Because we got some momentum from the local electeds, then we got momentum from community groups, advocacy groups, especially the disability groups. And it was just this amazing chain reaction, snowball effect of one group leading to another group. And as you well know, Arthur, there's a lot of parallels to what's going on now with what they try to do with BI. And so a lot of the people who stood up against Mount Sinai in their attempts to, you know, close BI joined us and joined me in our fights to save New York Guyanese. So it really, I really think that the spark it started with me and my patient who says, you know, she was working for Village Preservation, who then introduced me to Andrew Berman, who then introduced me to Harvey. And we got a group together. And when you have a lot of people who have a lot of experience and ideas, you can figure out ways to attack this plan. And one of the key things was we needed to get a hold of this certificate of need application that Mount Sinai had submitted. You know, the master sneak move here is to make New York Guyanese a branch or subsidiary of Beth Israel. So basically eliminate New York Guyanese certificate altogether. And by doing that, it's just erasing the box, as one of the council people said at the last meeting. You delete that box, then it's even easier to start moving pieces around. We got a hold of that certificate of need application. We were able to submit a lot of written comments to the Department of Health about that application, and then able to get enough opposition, public opposition at the subcommittee level. So there's for our listeners who don't know, when a certificate of need application has to be approved, it goes through several steps. It goes through a Department of Health staff summary, and then which is a very, you know, they just kind of do a thorough review of the application. Most of the times, as long as there's no red flags, they say it's fine. There's a subcommittee meeting of the Public Health and Health Planning Council that reviews the application. And if they approve it, then the full council meets to approve it. We were at the step of the subcommittee level, we were able to stop a recommendation. And at the full council level, we were able to stop a recommendation, which I've heard is
stop a recommendation in favor.
It's stop a recommendation in favor or approving the application, which I've been told is unprecedented. Well, it hasn't happened like in 10 years. I was elated. I didn't think we would get it to stop at the full council. I was very, from what I heard it was immensely difficult.
Let me ask one of the, having been someone involved in the Beth Israel fight, I actually sued about it. I was actually a plaintiff and the lawyer in the case. In that fight, there weren't a lot of doctors involved because by the time the neighborhood activists learned about what was going on, most of the doctors had fled the hospital. Mm-hmm. They went elsewhere, other hospitals, or maybe they took positions uptown at Mount Sinai. Here, you go to meetings and you go to picket lines and you got a lot of people in their doctor uniforms. Mm-hmm. So how did that get accomplished, and why is that different there than was it at Beth Israel?
That's a great question. I think there's a strong sense of loyalty and family for those of us who have trained there, who have worked there. You know, we are a smaller hospital than Beth Israel, and we really work, you know, I think because we're so focused, you know, we have worked so closely together that the bond and our loyalty to the institution is very, very intense and very high. So, from alumni support behind the scenes, from current faculty there who are very concerned about their future with this merging of certificates as to, wait, will I now, like, where will I work? Will I now just be a Beth Israel employee, or will we be doing all our surgeries at Beth Israel, versus, you know, just a lot of uncertainty about it. And that's the thing, is it's not so much if I mean, there's issues with the plan, but it's also how the plan was executed in terms of not talking to anybody about it and stealthily putting it into the Department of Health. And I think that's where the full council really had challenges. The people who opposed it said, we have a lot of people here who didn't know about this and don't, and they named out, you know, they named the faculty and the staff that had serious concerns about it. And it's just, I really think it's poor leadership. It's poor communication, a lack of transparency. So it's, in answer to your question, the doctors who've worked there, it's a family. We're very tight with each other just because we've worked so closely together. It's like the military. You know, once you go through that training, you work there and you're taking care of such really challenging patients, where you're on the brink of, you know, really losing somebody's eye, and you're working in a small space and you're all working as a team. It really brings people really close together.
You know, I think that it's interesting because when the professionals working in a hospital organize, they have a much greater impact than us community members. Just look at the nurses' strike. You know, that strike could, I mean, unless Mount Sinai and the other hospitals break their agreements, have a profound effect on the ratio of nurses to patients. Profound. I mean, the ratio was horrible, and the nurses doing that, they had a lot of power. You doctors organizing, I think, if a bunch of community people went to the Public Health Council and said, "Don't close our hospital," I don't know that they would have listened. But when they heard from a whole bunch of doctors, it gave them pause. So now the it still goes up to the health commissioner, this proposal, right? Mm-hmm. So for people who don't know, a certificate of need is required under the public health law if certain changes are going to be made in any in various medical facilities. There's a list of changes. They actually when they did it at Beth Israel, they broke what they wanted to do up into about 15 different pieces and then said they were minor changes. But if you added the 15 together, they would make a huge change. Here, they just did it all in one. Mount Sinai did it all in one thing. So it's a 340-page certificate of need, which raises a lot more flags. And they did send it for a public hearing. But it's going to go up to the health commissioner anyway, even though the Public Health Council did not give it a positive recommendation. Mm-hmm. Do you get any sense, you know, that the Hochul administration and the commissioner health, who have basically supported even the nonprofit hospitals' efforts to downsize and quote, make more money, mm-hmm. that they're going to be receptive? Any sense of that?
I don't have a sense. I'm optimistic though that because of all the opposition to it, that they won't move quickly on it. I don't have a sense. I do know that we're still working hard to galvanize as much support, in terms of just voicing, you know, making the commissioner know that, that there's a lot of public opposition to this. I was reassured that he would read everything in the file. There was a lot of written comments in opposition to it, but it's a really good question. I do know this. He was recently appointed. His name is James McDonald. He's an interim and he needs to get confirmed. And then there's a big budget, you know, because Hochul, a big part of the budget is the health part of the, but you know, the health plan, that his next few weeks is really focusing on the budget, making that, you know, worthy of approval passed. And then he also has to be focused on getting confirmed. So our strategy really is to really work with our elected officials and let the public community know, reach out to your assemblymen, reach out to your state senators, in support of New York INEAR and in opposition, you know, please tell them that you're not, you're opposed to the application, to the merger. I'm hopeful, but I, you know, it's hard to predict.
No, I know you're not you're becoming a political strategist. You went from being a doctor to a political strategist. We have this major problem, and after our interview is over, I'm going to play something from Bernie Sanders in 2019. But we have lost dozens of hospitals in the New York City area in the last 5 years, as the big hospitals have gobbled up all of the smaller hospitals, and often closed. They gobbled them up and closed them, right? And some people consider it to be a crisis. And the only reason Beth Israel didn't close, I'll take credit for my litigation, but it didn't close because the COVID pandemic hit before they got to do what they wanted to do, which was, by the way, to move to the New York INEAR building and build seven stories on top of it, but with only 70 beds. They have 800 beds. So, but COVID hit, and it was really hard for them to justify going from 800 beds to 70 when during the pandemic, every bed in that hospital was full. And, and it was after the first 2 years of the pandemic that they said, okay, we're not going to close. Although vast areas of that hospital, you walk down the halls, there's nobody there. Because they eliminated all but the general surgery unit. They eliminated heart surgery and they eliminated the maternity area. They eliminated pediatric surgery. They eliminated all kinds of orthopedic surgery. All the things that made a lot of money for the hospital. But it's there. So we sort of, we and the forces of nature kept that hospital from closing. But do you think that if there is a success here in keeping this hospital open and in basically saying to Mount Sinai, nope, there's a line here, you're not going to go past it, that it could serve as an example about how you can stop things and maybe we will see less hospital closings in New York for the few that are left?
I hope so. I mean, I think that the public really spoke out here. I hope so. I mean, the thing is, what I told Dr. Tsai, and there's nothing, I'm not hiding anything from him. I'm a straight shooter. I'm an honest guy. And I told him when he approached me about why he saw my testimony at the subcommittee meeting. I said, there's no commitment from Mount Sinai to New York INEAR. You know, since 2013, talent has drained, services have been drained, and trust has been broken. You know, there's been no commitment from Mount Sinai to New York INEAR, which translates to no commitment to the community, right? So, and that's what the community sense, like, you're abandoning us, and the doctors sense that too. So it's a great example of terrible leadership in terms of transparency, in terms of buy-in. I reflected on my own. You know, I supervise, I'm the chief of ophthalmology at the Bronx VA. James J. Peters in the VA in the Bronx. I've been the chief since 2017. I reflected on my own leadership, skills. And, you know, I reflected on what do I need to do better as in terms of my own staff. And it's really an example of leadership not being transparent and engaging with the staff. I tried to tell Jeremy that you're going to get resistance on this. You're going to get resistance from a lot of people on this, from the alumni, from faculty. I made it very clear to him, and he made it clear to me that he's proceeding. And so we agree to disagree. We're in a really challenging situation. We, you know, as far as moving forward, I'm in frequent conversations with our team, and I don't know. It's really tricky in terms of how to, if we succeed in this, how do we build New York Eye and Ear back to the beacon that it was? Can Sinai commit to us? Can they invest in us, and which translates to investing in the community? And these are all questions that need to be, you know, asked. And I don't know. It's very up in the air right now.
And just going to a last point I wanted to make is that if they do, and I had an opportunity over the last couple of days to look at the financials from New York Eye and Ear, and it was netting a lot of money. It's not a money losing operation. And when they start fooling around with hospitals, they might create a situation like they did at Beth Israel, where Beth Israel was a money making operation until they started pulling stuff and moving stuff around. And now it loses tons of money every year.
Yeah.
And they're stuck with all these empty beds because they're worried about the, you know, how the public looks at Mount Sinai and the next need for that. So it certainly is, can be, if Mount Sinai was being smart, a very important part of their, lest I use the wrong words, money-making operation, even though they're a nonprofit.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Thank you.
I really appreciate
you. Thank you for having me.
I really appreciate your work. It's inspiring as a community activist to have doctors walking around with the community people and testifying in front of the Public Health Council. And I expect to see you soon at whatever next meeting or action that we go forward with. So thank you very much.
We'll keep in touch.
Thank you. All right. We're going to take a 5:36. All right. The next part of our show, usually I do some music at this stage, but talking to Dr. Lee was really illuminating. It's really inspiring when health professionals join the fight to make the institutions better. This is not a fight for their income or their money. This is a fight for the community that they're in, just like WBAI, which fights for the community that we all live in. And we need your support. I'll say it once again to stay on the air. We need you to go to WBAI.org. Let us bring you people like Dr. Lee. Let us cover important fights like this that aren't getting covered anywhere except in the very local papers and local press. Let's raise the issue. Get the word out there, but you have to help us do it by making donations. Please go to WBAI.org and make a donation. The second half of my show, I'm going to call the Bernie part, or the second, third of two third, second, the last third of my show. I'm going to call it the Bernie section. But one of the things that, because I happen to be one of those people, and I don't think I'm a groupie, that thinks that Bernie Sanders continues to be one of the most profound politicians in America. He is somebody who can both be a democratic socialist, a rabble rouser, and yet rise to the highest levels of power in the United States. And he is actually currently the chair of the Senate Health, Labor, Pension Committee, and which is maybe the most important in terms of legislation, the most important committee that exists in the Senate, and at the same time, he doesn't just sit around in Washington. He travels around the country, uses his influence as a senator to try to get involved with local people and local struggles. Maybe we'll see him fighting from New York Eye and Ear. But anyway, I'm going to play a little clip from 2019 with Bernie talking about a hospital in Philadelphia called the Hahnemann Hospital that he was joining with local folks who were trying to keep it open. And he talks about the fight to stop hospital closings in the United States and how the closings reflect badly on our health system.
As all of you know, the possible closure of Hahnemann has nothing to do with health care. It has everything to do with greed, corporate greed. It is about a national health care system in America, which is dysfunctional because its goal is not to provide health care to all people as a right, but is to make as much money as possible for the insurance companies, the drug companies, and in this case, real estate speculators. Wrong. That is immoral. That is not what this country is about. We believe that health care is a human right, and we're going to fight for a system that is based on human needs, not corporate profits. Health care is not a commodity to be bought and sold to the highest bidder. Healthcare is something that every person in this city, in this state, in this country is entitled to because they are a human being. In the immediate moment where we are right now, we stand in solidarity with doctors, nurses, community groups, and local elected officials who are fighting to save Hahnemann from being destroyed by a real estate speculator. But what we must also understand is that this is not just a Philadelphia issue. It is not just a Vermont issue. It is a national issue. Since 2010, over 100 hospitals in the United States have shut down. And if we do not get our act together and put people before profits, hundreds more will soon be shutting down. Make no mistake about it. If an investment banker like Joel Friedman is able to shut down this, Joel Friedman is able to shut down Hahnemann and make a huge profit by turning this hospital into luxury condos, it will send a signal to every vulture fund on Wall Street that they can do the same thing in community after community after community. We cannot and we will not allow that to happen. And that is why I will be very soon introducing legislation in the Senate to establish a $20 billion emergency trust fund. Help states and local communities purchase hospitals that are in financial distress. In my view, anytime a hospital is put up for sale in America, the local community or the state must have the right to buy it first with emergency financial assistance. And I'll tell you what else we're going to do. We're going to end private equity funds from Wall Street vulture from owning hospitals in the first place. I'll tell you what else we have got to do, and that is the United States must do what every other major country on earth does, and that is guarantee health care to all through a Medicare for All single-payer program.
That was Bernie in 2019, and that is still Bernie today, after the pandemic, where we saw what a shambles the U.S. healthcare system was. There are estimates that 300,000 fewer people would have died if our healthcare system had been more accessible to people in hospitals, and people had been insured and not worried about going to the doctors when they got sick. We're going to play a short one of the things that has happened. As I said before, Bernie has become the chair of the Senate Committee on Health, Education, Pensions, and some other things. But health and education, I guess they used to be a Department of Education, but now they used to be a committee on education and a committee on health, and they've been combined into one. He is the chair of it. And I recommend that people go on online and YouTube. Bernie gave this, what we're going to play is something he just delivered on February 9th, last Friday, in one of the opening sessions of his committee, where he talked about the program that he wanted to accomplish in a bipartisan way. And then there's also a speech he gave called The State of the Working Class, which was given about 30 days ago, but it's also easy to find online. So I'm going to play a little bit about what Bernie said on the Senate at the opening committee meeting about his plans, which are, you know, he actually is one of the few senators that has an ability to work across party lines, which interestingly, and the, if you listen to the whole committee meeting, you'll find that the cordiality is astounding given how stringent Bernie's politics are. But he actually knows how to work with people. So we're going to listen to a little piece of this opening remarks he made last Friday at the Senate Committee on Health and Education. And then we'll come to our closing point. So, Reggie, if you could put that on. Thanks.
The title of this committee is Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions. And obviously within that very broad jurisdiction, which impacts virtually every American, there is an enormous amount of work to be done. So let me tell you kind of what my priorities are within that broad scope of work. In terms of healthcare, in my view, we have a broken and dysfunctional healthcare system. We spend twice as much per capita on healthcare as do the people of any other country, twice as much. And yet we have 85 million Americans who are uninsured or underinsured. We have some 500,000 people every year who go bankrupt because of medically related debt. Just think about that for a moment. You get leukemia, bad enough, then you go bankrupt because you can't pay the medical bills. And on top of all of that, we have some 68,000 people every year who die because they don't get to a doctor on time because they can't afford to go to a doctor. And as bad as the general healthcare system is, the primary healthcare system is struggling even worse. And when I talk about primary care, I am including the need to address the horrific mental health crisis. I don't know about you, but I go around my state, and no matter where you go, to schools, to police departments, wherever you go, it's mental health. It is worse than people perceive it. It was bad before, and the pandemic has certainly made it a lot worse. So we need to look at mental health And obviously the opioid crisis, which I know has hit New Hampshire very hard. It has now spread, thank you. We now have it in Vermont and all across this country. We lost over 100,000 people last year to opioids. But on top of all of that, we have nearly 100 million Americans who live in areas where it is difficult to access primary health care. Nearly 70 million live in areas where it is difficult to find a dentist. And I want to talk, during the course of our time here, talk about dental care, which is a serious problem. And then we have 150 million people who are finding it hard to find a mental health provider. So the question that we want to deal with, and we're going to deal with it pretty soon, we've got a hearing coming up, is how does it happen when we spend so much money per capita on health care? We don't have enough doctors. We don't have enough dentists. We don't have enough nurses. We don't have enough mental health care providers. We don't have enough pharmacists. So that's an issue that I think we got to lay on the table and see what we can do about that. And I should say that in the midst of all of that, Patty, you're late. I said some very nice things about you.
Thanks.
All right, you have to go look at the video. And all right. But despite all of those problems, the insurance companies made over $60 billion in profits last year. And then another issue that we will deal with, and I know there are divisions on this committee on that one, is it is my very strong view that it is a woman who has the right to control her own body and not the government. That is an important health care issue to many of us. And I believe the Dobbs Supreme Court decision was not only wrong, but way out of touch with where the American people are on this subject. In my view, we must codify Roe v. Wade and protect the reproductive rights of women. So, yes, if you look at all of the issues in front of us on health care, we have an enormous amount of work to do there. Part of that issue is prescription drugs. And interestingly enough, we did a little bit of research on this. But as both former President Trump and President Biden have both noted, we pay by far the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. And in some cases, we pay 10 times more than the Canadians and people around the world pay. What to me is totally insane. And I want to, you know, and again, these are issues I hope we can come together on. Somebody here tell me, if you think it's rational, that somebody cannot afford a prescription drug their doctors prescribe, they get sicker, they end up in an emergency room, maybe they end up in the hospital, maybe they die. Does that make sense to anybody in any way? And I am more than aware, and let's be clear about this, we're big boys and girls here. The pharmaceutical industry has 1,700 paid lobbyists roaming the halls of Congress, former leaders of the Democratic Party, former leaders of the Republican Party, well-paid, sophisticated people.
So that's a piece of Bernie's talk. It goes on for another 10 minutes, but where he outlines, and I miss labor, but it's the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pension Committee, which is a broad topic. One of the reasons I wanted to play what Bernie had to say is because so much of the coverage that we hear from Washington is about, you know, things that the Republicans are doing. The Republicans want to end Social Security. They want to end Medicaid. They want to do this. They want to do that. They want to have hearings about Hunter Biden. Who the hell cares about Hunter Biden? There are good things going on in Washington. There are people like Bernie. There is legislation that the Senate is going to move. There are going to be efforts to, and even if they don't pass in the next 2 years, just like in the last 2 years, a lot of stuff gets built on. And it's very important for us to pay attention to them and react to them and support what's going on there. Healthcare is such a critical missing piece in the U.S. mosaic. We learned that during the pandemic. What went on in this country, the lack of preparation was just disgraceful. It was disgraceful in most of the world, but particularly in what's supposed to be the which prides itself as a company with the greatest healthcare facilities in the world. We had the greatest death per capita in the world. And it wasn't just because Donald Trump was president. So we're going to talk a lot more about healthcare in the coming time. We're going to talk about the New York Health Act, which is an effort to bring Medicare for all, single-payer health, to New York. And it's sitting there on top of the legislature. this coming session, and maybe it'll get passed. And if it does, the world in New York is going to be profoundly changed. So please join us next week on Advocating for Justice. And we will talk about the New York Health Act. We're going to talk to some members of the assembly who are on the cutting edge on that and other issues. And I'm going to close with Beyonce singing Change is Going to Come. And I usually like to end my show with Change is Going to Come because it's a hopeful song. And who else better than Beyonce, who last week became the foremost winner of Grammy Awards ever in history. So we'll see everybody next week. Please go to WBAI.org and make your contribution. Here's Beyonce.
I was born by the river in a little tent. And oh, just like that river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.
This is Mike Sargent with This Day in Racial Injustice. On this day, February 15th in 1848, 5-year-old Sarah Roberts was barred from a white school in Boston. Her father, Benjamin Roberts, filed the first school integration suit on her behalf. The city had required that Sarah enroll in an all-black public elementary school, the Abiel Smith School, one of the number of segregated schools for colored children in Boston. It was far from where the family lived. Benjamin Roberts, Sarah's father and one of the nation's first African-American printers, challenged the Boston School Committee's policy of racial segregation and sought to enroll her at a school closer to their home. Lawyer Robert Morris, one of the first African-American lawyers, argued that the Constitution of Massachusetts held all men, without distinction of color or race, equal before the law, and that the laws of the state that established public schools also made no distinctions. Yet, in 1850, Chief Justice Lemuel Shaw of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, one of the most influential state courts in the country, held that racial segregation in public schools was permitted under the Massachusetts Constitution and laws. Sarah and Benjamin Roberts lost their legal challenge in the Massachusetts courts. However, their efforts anticipated the successful struggle for civil rights in the 1950s and 1960s, especially in the landmark case of Brown versus the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas in 1954, more than a century after young Sarah Roberts was a student. This has been This Day in Racial Injustice, from Massachusetts' Long Road to Justice Initiative, and this is listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI in New York.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be ours.
Mumia's Freedom is Labor's Cause, a Black History Month event on Thursday, February 16th at 6 p.m. at the Actors Temple Theater, 339 West 47th Street in Manhattan. This Thursday, February 16th, West Coast Longshore Unionists are shutting down Bay Area ports. Their demand and slogan, an injury to one is an injury to all. Free Mumia Abu-Jamal. Here in New York, a teach-in will be held in solidarity with this action. Join New York leaders of the Transport Workers Union, the Teamsters, the Laundry Workers Center, the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists, as well as CUNY historians and students. They will stand in solidarity with West Coast dock workers who are shutting down Bay Area ports this week to demand freedom for Mumia. Police and prosecutors framed the imprisoned radio journalist and veteran Black Panther, who's been imprisoned for over four decades. Join us at the teach-in, Mumia's Freedom is Labor's Cause, Thursday, February 16th at 6 p.m. at the Actors Temple Theater, 339 West 47th Street in Manhattan. Join us at this critical juncture in the case as the call for Mumia's freedom spreads among organized workers from Oakland to South Africa.
And the previous program was Advocating for Justice with Arthur Schwartz, heard Wednesdays at 5 p.m. here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and